Just to be clear, what's really important here, those sanctions, they're not nothing, but they're not grave, and they're not in any way sort of strategically going to change the economy in a strategic way at all. But what was the red line? Well, there were two things. One was at Anchorage, the Russians understood from Trump that he would keep sanctions away from Russia to allow it to pursue a political solution. And secondly, that red line has been broken with these sanctions. It's not so much an economic matter. Why Russia takes it so seriously, it is a political red line that has been broken. And the second political red line was the one there would be no frozen conflict on the site as it is, now it is, this is going to be a frozen conflict, which all most Russians understand is a trap that they have to avoid. And they've been in this before, Minsk, and even going back to 1918 and that treaty there where they lost Ukraine and parts of Poland and elsewhere. Everyone understands. And when I was in St. Petersburg just a couple of months ago, St. Petersburg is the liberal cap of Russia. I mean, always connected to the West. It's, you know, there's a station, a Finnish station, Finland station is right in St. Petersburg. And there, you know, people said very clearly, listen, we've invested blood to get to this point. And we are not about to see another Minsk Accord, a deceit imposed on us so that the West can rearm and regroup in Ukraine. And that then we will have to spill more blood in 3 or 4 years' time. We just not going to accept that. Putin may not do a deal like that. It's unacceptable. We've spent enough on it. We want the thing to be completed. We want it to be done with. So, I mean, it's not a question of political affiliation or being pro-Putin or anti-Putin. This is how people feel about, you know, the threat to their children.
So let me ask you a question, because the most likely, I guess, solution for that is, which Putin has said himself here recently, in Beijing most recently, they'll just accomplish it on the battlefield. They'll take what they want by force of arms to accomplish their security needs as they see them. Or he reiterated there, they will take it at the diplomatic table. What can, as best as you can ascertain, what would a diplomatic solution look like right now that's acceptable to Russia? And let's just look at it from that perspective right now. Is there a deal that Russia would actually accept on the negotiating table to bring this to an end?
Oh, yes. I mean, and we saw it. It was the deal, which was largely inked and initialed by the Ukrainian side in Istanbul in 22. And it included the issue of neutrality and no NATO, and it included questions of troop levels and foreign troops being involved with it, and it included, if you like, guarantees that Russia and other states would give to Ukraine. And then Boris Johnson was sent by the collective security structures and said, no way, you can't normalize with Russia.
But the two issues that were the most contentious, I think, there's a lot of them, but two of it may be the most hardest for the Ukraine, if not impossible, the demilitarization and the denazification. So instead of getting security guarantees from the West, they're going to get a rump military left over, like a Weimar or Weimar Republic type, 100,000 troops, et cetera. And then what would a denazification look like? That may be the biggest one of all, because that would imply some sort of political change inside of Ukraine, willingly.
Well, of course. It is inevitable because, you know, really starting back in 48, 49, the British, actually started preparing. It had its old stay-behind forces that were infiltrating Russia, and they were then turned to be stay-behind forces against the Soviet Union. And those were linked with the Ukraine. Many of them were Ukrainians. I mean, that is Western Ukrainian. And so at the time of the Maidan, both CIA and MI6 carefully put in people into the police, into the military, the intelligence, and the political echelons who would be fiercely and could be counted on to be totally anti-Russian, Russophobes, and would stay with the extreme, if you like, nationalist position that you cannot deal with Russia and you cannot make an accord with Russia. So we, the West, I mean, in Britain and America, put those people in precisely to prevent an accord being signed between the two. So when it came to it, as I say, in Istanbul in 22, and when, the Ukrainians have signed most of those papers, or at least initialed. It was never agreed, of course, but it was signed off by them. The answer is no. And one of the reasons is because that cadre that was installed after Maidan and sort of selected from people that had a past, will never agree to this, will never back down. And that's why Russia keeps going on about denazification, is saying that, the hatred of those people for Russia is so intense and has, got a history going back so far, not Maidan, but right back into the Second World War period.
Yeah.
You can't come to an agreement. And in a sense, if you can't talk to the other side, if it's not possible and they won't talk to you. And I've always said that. I've been involved in many sort of negotiations, ceasefires and things like that. I mean, the first thing is you've got to get to the point that Rand was making, interestingly enough, is that you have to recognize, you can say, look, I don't agree with this man, my opponent. I don't agree with him. I don't agree with his history is completely wrong. And his vision for the future, I can't accept that either. But I now accept that this person has a legitimate point of view and is a representative of his people or her people. Once you say that, then politics is possible. But if those people will not talk and will not have anything to do with Russian, and we only have to look at the history of them trying, having to suppress the Russian language, suppress, everything Russian during that period. I mean, the chances of being able to sit down and have a serious talk, as soon as they learn a bit, it'll be stopped. So that's what he means by denazification. It's not, it's not to try and sort of put a political character, a category, and say, anyone who's on the right is not allowed. It's not that sort of, European style, cordon sanitaire. It is simply saying, there have to be people, Ukrainians, military, whatever, but who are able to talk and able to come to terms.
So given the history that you just talked about, let's run from MI6, CIA, going all the way back to 47, 40, 48, et cetera, that seeds that were planted then. Is there, if we're just being honest, is there even a rational possibility to get to a negotiated denazification that's acceptable to Russia? Or literally, have we baked in that Russia can only have a military victory here and be satisfied?
I see no basis. As things stand, I see no basis for a negotiated settlement involving United States and Russia about Ukraine. I see no basis for it at all. I think we're deceiving ourselves if we think it's possible. If there's a change in the circumstances, if something happens in this next period in the sort of Donbass and other areas, who knows? But at the moment, I see no prospect of it. And so, and also, given the sense that, the mood in the team of Trump is now solidly against any negotiation with, not solidly, there's Witkoff, of course, but solidly against any sort of real negotiation with it. They've turned you know, there's been a big shift. You know, not so long ago, most of the West was saying, oh, well, you know, Ukraine can win and we can, Ukraine is going to succeed and thing. Now we've gone to the other side, is how to define failure, how to define failure as victory. I mean, you know, yes, now we can try and pretend it's victory because, you know, oh, Russia, you know, actually it's eating up their economy, this war, it's eating it up. They're getting weaker and weaker and, you know, with time. So that it is a sort of holding exercise, a victory, not this year, next year, but 3 years' time. And the Europeans sort of lap this up and say, yes, you know, we just got to put enough money aside. And then 3 years' time or something like that, Russia will be so weakened. I mean, it's nonsense, complete nonsense. It's a fabrication. It's just psyops, that's all.
Yeah. Well, that's where we are right now. And I guess we're going to have to wait and see, as you say, what could happen in the Donbass and then in both Kupiansk and in Pokrovsk, which could change the dynamic on the battlefield. We'll have to see how that plays out here in the coming period of time. But we are incredibly grateful for having you come on today, especially in talking about a lot of these issues here. And we would definitely like to send folks back to your Conflicts Forum, a geopolitical oracle, and on your Substack forum, because lots of great, great stuff there. And that's one of the reasons we were glad to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you very much. It was, of course, as I said, the outset, a pleasure to join you.
I look forward to having you back real soon. And we thank you guys for being with us today. And also to let you know, actually less than 30 minutes from now, we've got another great international relations theorist here on this side of the pond. John Mearsheimer is going to be talking about this new nuclear arms race and just what in the hell is going on with that. I said 30 minutes. That's actually at 1 o'clock today. So about an hour and a half from now, we'll look forward to seeing you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.